lens and walk through that because it's so deep and rich in our in understanding our salvation. That we need to talk about Ephesians because Ephesians and the church is just a beautiful depiction of, you know, Christ's love for his bride, the church, and how we can be, you know, proclaim that in our marriages. But no one's like, yeah, let's talk about a fat man who gets stabbed and fecal matter spills out of his stomach. No one's like, sign me up for that. So forewarning you, that's what we're talking about this morning. So if you're a little queasy, you might want to exit now because we're going to be talking about some pretty detailed stuff. The Bible is graphic. When you read it and you study it and you're spending time reading the whole thing, it gets intense. And there's stuff in here you're going, ah, why and how does that apply to my faith? So we're going to be in Judges this morning, Judges chapter 3, and we're going to take a look at Ehud and a very large king. Judges chapter 3. We're going to be in verses 12 through the end, well, close to the end, verse 30. All right, now, when I read this, I'm going to do my very best not to giggle like a sixth grader, because I know some of the sixth graders over here are going to giggle. But it's meant to actually be funny, and we'll talk about that in a second. So, verse 12, chapter 3 of Judges. And the people of Israel, again, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Surprise there. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel. They took possession of the city of Palms, and the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, then the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Jerah, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab, and he had made for himself a sword, two edges and a cubit in length, and he bound it on his right thigh under his clothes. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. But he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he commanded silence, and all his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat, and Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And the hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the dung came out. I heard giggles. I don't know who it was. There's someone over here who's giggling. Emily, come on. So the dung came out. Verse 23, then Ehud went out into the porch and closed the doors and the roof chambers behind him, and locked them. When he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, surely he is relieving himself in the closet of the cool chamber. And they waited there till they were embarrassed. But when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened it, and there lay their Lord dead on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed, and he passed beyond the idols and escaped to Seira. When he came, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. Then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was their leader. And he said to them, follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites and did not allow anyone to pass over. And they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had peace or rest for 80 years. Again, what in the world is this talking about? Like, what does this have to do with our faith? How do we apply this to our lives? At face value, to me, what it says is you need to exercise or you're going to get stabbed. Like, that's what I draw from it practically, right? If you don't exercise, you get overweight and someone's going to come into your house and stab you. Like, that's what do we draw from this? What we're going to see is kind of this theme that Ehud was the right left-handed man. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but Ehud was the right left-handed man, meaning that God had him in the right place at the right time for the right reason in order to fulfill his will. And what we're drawing from this morning is we're going to see that God has called Christians to be world changers by fulfilling his purposes wherever they find themselves, with whatever they have. So to understand what's happening here, we kind of have to grasp kind of the history of Israel, and that helps wrap our mind around things and even some of the stuff that we're reading. So it is actually really okay to giggle at this story. That's the intended point. That's why there's so much detail and so much ridiculous information in this passage, is because the author is sketching kind of a literary cartoon that pokes fun at the Moabites in order to bring glory to God. The whole point of this passage is to poke fun at the Moabites and the king and elevate and raise up the view of Israel and Israel's God. We must recognize that the author carefully crafts an anti-Moabite satire. You know, you read those satirical things that are kind of making fun of stuff. This is how this is written. This is why we have the details in here. When the readers read this, they're supposed to be like, that's funny. So it's okay to laugh. Emily, you were good. What we see, taking place here, what's happening is Israel has been freed from Egypt. They went through the Exodus. They went through that time of the wilderness years, and now they are in the Promised Land, and God is leading his people, and he uses judges to lead the people. I'd love to say that Israel had their life together and that they followed God consistently and constantly, but they did not. And so in Judges, what you read is you see this continual cycle, the same thing happen over and over and over again. We read it in the very first verse there in verse 12, and the people again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. See, what's happening here is there's a cycle of sin that kind of takes place in the lives of God's people. So you have Israel, that they serve God for a time and they follow after him. They're all about God, but then Israel does something, whether it be idol worship or whatever it is, then they then turn from God and run from God. And then God brings his discipline in, which is usually enslavement from another nation. And after a while, Israel finally dawns on them that they need God. So then they cry out to God for deliverance. Then God sends a judge. Israel is then delivered, and then Israel continues to serve God for a certain amount of time, and then they sin, and then they cry out, and then God sends a judge, and then they're delivered, and then they're good, and then they sin, and it just keeps going and going and going and going and going, which is not actually much different than our own lives. If we really think about our own lives and how we live, this is very similar to the cycle of sin that we see in our own lives. Things are going well. We're serving God. There's this blessing in our lives. Things are great. But then something pulls us away from God. We are enticed away from God, and we fall into disobedience. We do things that God goes directly against God's commands in our lives. And as a result, because we are God's children and he loves us, he brings in discipline. He brings in this discipline in order to help us see our need for him, so that then we confess our sin, then we can repent from our sin, be delivered from our sin, and get back to serving God the way that he has called us to do. And this is this cycle that continues. So what you see in your own life is blessing, disobedience, discipline, confession, repentance, deliverance, and blessing. And it just keeps going and going and going. What we're in that kind of order, what we're focusing on today is that discipline. Is that discipline? Is that because God loves his people, he doesn't want them to continue doing things that are going to hurt them and harm them. He doesn't want them to be far from him. He wants to have a very intimate and close relationship with him, with his people. And so what God does in our lives and what he did in the lives of Israel was he brought these agents of change. He brought agents of change. God uses the judges, as you read throughout the book of Judges, as agents of change, meaning the nation of Israel were doing things they shouldn't and needed to make a change. Not that the judges brought about the change in their lives, not that the judges brought the transformation, but they sparked seeing the need for God. God uses judges as agents of change, and he uses, in our lives, men and women as agents of change, and he can even use us as agents of change. Meaning that men and women speaking truth into our lives, calling us out of our sin, or people who are agents of change. We have the opportunity to minister to people. When we're seeing a deficiency in someone's life, we're able to minister to them, to disciple them, to mentor them, to speak truth into their lives. And so there are times that we are called to be agents of change. Agents of change are men and women used by God to accomplish his plan of deliverance, redemption, and transformation. That's what we are called to do as the people of God. We are called to be world changers. Not that we are the ones causing the change, because only Jesus Christ can cause that change, but we are to go and to declare that message so that people might hear and see their need for Jesus. What Ehud points to is that God brings the right people at the right time in the right roles to accomplish his plan. So I happened to be in the right place at the right time one time. There was a kid in our youth group at the time who was sort of kind of obsessed with LeBron James. And his mother worked out a VIP, like backstage passes, to actually meet LeBron James. So I was just lucky enough to be the youth pastor at the time, I think is what happened. And they invited me to go along. So I'm like, yeah, I like basketball, and I'm going to meet someone famous. That's cool. So we went up to a 76ers game. We drove to Philadelphia, went to a 76ers game. The Miami Heat were playing the 76ers. We got to meet LeBron James at the very beginning of the game, like right before the game. He signed. I even have like my pass that signed, and we got to hang out and just like be around the court. Like, you know how those like guys who step foot on court and then they're tackled by security? Because we had those little badges, that didn't happen to us. So we got to like be on the court. So we're watching like Shane Battier warm up, and a bunch of other guys, you know, Juan Howard, if you guys are a little old school and know him. Like, it's just, it was really cool to be there in the presence of all these like 7 foot, I felt small. Like, I'm 6'3", and I typically don't feel small. And in that moment, as I'm walking under someone's arm as he's signing autographs, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, Goliath, that's cool. Now I understand. So we're at the game, and we got nosebleed seats, so we weren't even close. So we were enjoying the game. Pretty sure the 76ers got crushed, because they typically do. Sorry, they're just bad. And we, after the game, or during the game, the tension was drawn to like the front of the court where one of the part owners was sitting, which if you know anything about Philadelphia, you know that Philadelphia, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, is kind of centered in Philadelphia, and one of the owners of the 76ers is Will Smith. And so he and his wife were at the game, and they were, you know, kind of standing up and waving to people, that sort of thing. So I got a picture. I'm like, ah, cool, there's Will Smith. So it was really fun. We walked out after the game, and we just headed back to our car, and there's like this crowd of people kind of forming this line. I'm like, what in the world's happening? This is bizarre. And it dawned on me. I'm like, wait a second. I bet Will Smith's about to walk out those doors. So I encouraged the guys that were there. I was like, okay, let's just stay here for a second. Like, it's already like 10 o'clock. You know, we're going to get back late. Let's stay a couple minutes and see what happens. And so we're standing there in the line. And so there's a line of us people, and then there's a line across from us, like kind of making this path, these like limousine kind of SUV looking things. And this elevator starts to drop, and people are getting excited. And they're like, wow, wow, wow. And the elevator door opens up, and out walks Will Smith. And I'm like, I'm going to get LeBron James' signature and Will's signature. You just watch this. So we're standing there, and I have my pen ready, got my pass ready, and he comes walking up, and I'm like, and he just goes like that, like no. But then he goes. And so I reach out my hand, and I fist bump Will Smith. I have yet to wash this hand. This one right here. So I shook your hand this morning. No, it was awesome. I was like, I fist bumped him, like, that's totally cool. Like, the guy who is in Fresh Prince, he's a rapper, a musical artist, just well known for his movies. I got to fist bump him. I was in the right place at the right time to experience that. And it's honestly what it comes down to. I'm pretty sure, like 98% sure, that God didn't orchestrate that for me to fist bump. Maybe he did. I don't know. Maybe it's just for this moment God orchestrated me to be able to fist bump, to share this story, to talk about being in the right place at the right time. I don't know. God's bigger than I am. But I feel like it's just, you know, dumb luck that I tripped into it. But when it comes to God, there's never such dumb luck in ministry. You know, when we feel God's call into an area and we begin to see God's work and people's lives are being transformed and changed, that's not luck. It was God bringing the right people at the right time for his results, for what he wanted. It's a result of God's sovereignty over our lives. And what, when it comes to God in a relationship and being these agents of change, it's us aligning ourselves to his sovereignty. It's us coming under his sovereignty, being willing to serve him, whatever it might be, wherever he might call us to be. And there are three things in this passage, the three elements that help us align ourselves to God's sovereignty that we can see in Ehud's life. And the first is proximity. Proximity. Proximity allows you to capitalize on sudden divinely appointed opportunities. Ed Stetzer is an American author, speaker, researcher, pastor, church planner, guru. He said this. He said, if we're going to stand faithful in faithless times, we're going to have to leave where we are comfortable. We can't engage effectively by going along with the culture, but neither can we engage evangelistically without living in the culture. So kind of his point is that be in the world, but not of the world. He's saying that we can't, our message is going to fall on deaf ears if our lifestyles and the choices that we make, it all looks very similar to the world. However, we can't be evangelistic in our efforts if we're not actually in the world, if we're not living among them and surrounding ourselves with people who need to hear about Jesus. And so what Ehud's life points to is that proximity allows you to capitalize on sudden divinely appointed opportunities. That Ehud was the right man in the right place at the right time because God wanted him there. We see this in verses 12 through 15. It says, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of Palms. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. So what we see here is Israel is in need of deliverance, redemption, and transformation, which is a part of God's plan for his people. He wants us to be delivered, he wants to redeem us, and he wants to transform us because of their sin, because they were doing things that they shouldn't. If you read in verses 11 through 15 in chapter 2, we see some of these things that they were doing that they shouldn't be doing. So then the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the God of the fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them, and they bowed to them. And they provoked the Lord with anger. They abandoned the Lord their God and served Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to the plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hand of the surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. So in that passage, we get a glimpse of this evil that they keep falling back into. That when we read that they did again what was evil in the sight of the Lord, it's probably like they fell back into idol worship. They fell back into those bad habits. So they were backslidden. They were falling back into the sin that they had been struggling with and continued to struggle with, likely because they're spiritually unfocused. They continued to take their eyes off of God. They were unfocused. They weren't focused on the one they should have been focused on. So God brings an agent of discipline in a form of King Moab to wake Israel up. He used Eglon, the Moabite king, along with the Ammonites and the Amalekites. And what we read here is Eglon's a rather large dude. He's fat. I don't know what exactly that means in the text, but he's a big guy. And apparently he was super, 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 super overweight, that his name actually means like cow. Okay, so this guy was massive, and it was known that he was massive. And the events of the chapter, as you read through these, it demonstrates that Eglon's bodily corpulence matches his mental obtuseness, meaning he's fat and dumb. That he's just as big as he is, that's just how dumb that he is. And he's very open to things that he shouldn't have been open to. Instead of serving and ruling from his city, he actually rules from Jericho, which is the city of Palms here, because it was comfortable. It would have been very comfortable, almost like an oasis. And so he was living high on the hog. He was enjoying it, and he didn't care about anything else. And because of that, he was low in his mental stature. Again, this passage, it's all about humor. It's all about that satire. And so God uses this Moabite king to help correct his people. The point of this, the reason why there's so much emphasis on how big he was and how dumb he was to show that God can use anything to help correct his people. God can use anything to help correct his people. No matter how smart you are or dumb you think you are, God can use you to help correct his people. He used a pagan king and nations. He used enemies and even used circumstances in order to wake up Israel to their need for him. God can use whatever he wants, however he wants, in order to reach his people. So after 18 years, I mean, this blows my mind. When I study and I read through this, I think through how in the world, like 18 years, they were enslaved before they were like, we need God. Like, how are you enslaved for 18 years, and after 18 years, you finally come to your senses that you need God? It's not so much different to even our own lives. There are people that we're praying for and still praying for in this church because they don't see their need for God. And we're going on not 18 years, but 25 years and 30 years. Men and women who are on their deathbed who we're praying, they see their need for Jesus. So sin is at rule and reign in Israel's heart, and it has pulled them as far as they could from God. And so it took God sending an extreme situation into their lives in order to wake them up. So the people come to their senses and they see their need for God's help. Part of the reason why the book of Judges was written was not primarily to mock foreigners, but it was to challenge the Israelites to reflect on their own condition. The reason why there's so much emphasis behind the physical and mental stature of the king was to show Israel that they weren't all cracked up to what they thought they were. They weren't as noble and awesome and wonderful as they thought they were, because now they've been reduced less to this Moabite king. So God sends a deliverer from among the people to pull them out of their sin, help them to see their need for God, and to deliver them from bondage. And what we read, we're introduced to Ehud in chapter 2, verse 15. The people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. God raises a deliverer from among the people. Ehud was, as we read here, an Israelite, specifically from the tribe of Benjamin. That might not mean a whole lot to us. We hear the tribe of Benjamin, and there's some names that kind of pop out to us that we know of, like King Saul and a few others. But when you actually get a map out and you start to look at where this is taking place in the city of Psalms, which is Jericho, and where Ehud is from, his tribe, you find that the city of Psalms, Jericho, is located in the land attributed to the tribe of Benjamin. So Jericho is found in the land of Ehud's people. So what we see here is that Ehud was in close proximity to the issue at hand. He was near to where God needed him to work. You know, I hunt, and I'm not as probably as skilled and as good, and nor do I have the time to dedicate myself to hunting. But hunters that are in this room, they know that you have to place yourself where you're going to be in close proximity to deer. Like if you set up in the middle of a desert, you're probably not going to find a deer. So you have to make sure that things are in play for you to capitalize on a deer walking through. So there's three things that most hunters look for. They look for a water source. Like if there's a water source, there's a good bet there's some wildlife around. They look for the path of least resistance, which are like saddles. So that deer can travel from one ridge to the next. They look for the easiest ways. They're like us. No one wants to walk straight up the side of a ridge. Like, it's just not fun for anybody. Deer are the same way. So they look for these little saddles that kind of cut between the two ridges so they can walk through. So hunters set themselves up near those. And then hunters also look for bedding areas where these deer lay down. The reason being is they want to be as close to where the action is so they have an opportunity to bag a big deer, We understand that if we want to capitalize on things, we have to be in close proximity. The same thing goes for our faith. We have to surround ourselves with as many gospel opportunities as you possibly can. You have to put yourself in close proximity to people who you can impact for the sake of Christ. This is why Paul went to Athens in Acts chapter 17. He went to probably the least reached city of the area. They were worshiping idols, other gods. They were far from God. And where does Paul go? He doesn't go to the church. He doesn't go to the city of churches. He goes to a place where there's probably no church, but it has the greatest need for hearing about Jesus. We have to put ourselves in close proximity to the people who we can impact for the sake of Christ. One of the greatest tragedies that the church has done is we have secluded ourselves in a Christian bubble. We've secluded ourselves in a Christian bubble. We don't want to surround ourselves with people who need to hear about Jesus. We want to surround ourselves with people who are exactly the same. And then we look at our lives and we wonder, man, why aren't we reaching people for Christ? Look at your circle. How many non-Christians do you have in your scope of relationships? And this is one of those things that each person has to consider themselves. Like, I'm not a huge advocate necessarily of Christian schools and necessarily a huge advocate of going to a Christian college. Not that those things are bad. I went to Christian college. I got my pastoral degree, so I was there. But if you are a person that's maybe not pursuing ministry, this is what you have to weigh. That is it more beneficial for you as if going to be a teacher and you want to get your teaching degree? Is it more beneficial for you to go to a Christian school surrounded by a bunch of other people who love Jesus? Or are you going to have a more impact ministry-wise going to a secular school where not a whole lot of people know about Jesus? See, these are the things that we actually have to weigh and think through. I'm not saying that you can't go to Christian school and that it's a bad thing if you do, if God's calling you there, by all means. I'm not God. I'm just saying these are the things we have to weigh. There are things that we have to consider. Is our lives set up for gospel opportunities? Are we in places where we can actually make a difference for the sake of Christ? Some of this might mean that we move into town rather than out of town. Your house surrounded by cornfields on all sides, what kind of impact are you going to make with your neighbors? Cows don't need Jesus. People do. How about coffee? Even something as simple as getting coffee. Do you instead go to the coffee shop that is owned by the local Christian where they play nice Christian music and you see beautiful verses on the walls and you look around and you're like, I know that person, where they go to church, and where they go to church? Instead, what if you went to the local coffee shop owned and run by a person that doesn't know Jesus? Maybe for you it's to get a job. Like, actually get a job. To surround yourself with people. For others, it might be looking at getting a job that surrounds you with people. Maybe that cubicle job isn't. Maybe it pays you more money where you're isolated and alone and focused. But is it the most beneficial for the kingdom that you are isolated and alone for 8 hours of the day when you could surround yourself with people? These are the things that we need to consider and weigh. For me, it's super hard. Like, unless I don't know my staff real well, I work in a Christian environment. I serve in a Christian environment. On Sunday mornings, my hope is that most of you have a relationship with Jesus. If not, I need to go back to like studying and figuring out how I can present the gospel better. But it's hard for me to like get into the world. I have to be very intentional personally about it. For me to wrap myself and to surround myself in proximity to non-Christians. One of the things, I absolutely hate this sport now. I honestly do. I loathe it, and I cannot stand it. It's softball. Oh, man. I do not like softball anymore. I enjoyed playing baseball. I love playing softball there for a while. But at this point in my life, I'm just like, ugh. But what I know is that there is a rec league in Newville at Heisman's softball complex. And I have been, for whatever reason, given the skill set to catch a ball every now and then. And I'm a pretty friendly guy. So I'm playing on a rec league in Newville in order to rub elbows with men that don't have Jesus. I can tell you some of the conversations that I hear. And I would have to have our youth and children exit quickly. It's not a Christian environment, but I have to be super specific, specifically for me and what I do for my life and vocation, to surround myself in close proximity with unbelievers. It is very easy to separate and seclude ourselves from those opportunities. And there are some things that we just have to consider as Christians. And so this is the challenge for us, is do we have opportunities? Have we placed ourselves in a position in order to capitalize when these divinely appointments come? You can't catch fish unless you're near the water. You can't catch fish unless you're near the water. So go be near the water. The second thing that we see in Ehud's life and how it aligns him to be able to do God's will, to align himself to God's sovereignty, is he practices. His practice prepares him to do what God had called him to do. For us, practice prepares us to do what God has called us to do. Practice prepares you when God calls you into action. Read with me again verse 16. It says, "And Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, and he bound it to his right thigh and under his clothes. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man, and when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people, and he carried the tribute. But he himself turned back to the idols, from the idols, near Gilgal, and said, 'I have a secret message for you, O king.' And he commanded silence, and all of his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in the cool of the chamber, and Ehud said, 'I have a special message from you from God.' And he arose from his seat, and Ehud reached his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, thrust it into his belly, and the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the dung came out. Then Ehud went out the porch and closed the doors in the roof of the chamber behind him and locked them." And then we see that he escapes. Like, when I grew growing up in the church, as I heard messages about Ehud, it was always presented to me that Ehud had some form of deformity. That he had maybe like a shriveled hand, or like something was wrong with his right hand, which is why he was forced to be left-handed. That's all that was kind of presented to me. But what's really interesting about this passage is the bulk of the narrative is devoted to not describing God's actions, but to narrating the achievements of the agent whom God had called to rescue the Israelites from the Moabite oppression. Like, the focus of this passage, you know, there's not a whole lot of mention of God once we hear Ehud's name until after he kills the king and escapes. There's a massive amount of focus on who Ehud is and what he does. The text is very focused on him because apparently, to the writer, to the author of the book, Ehud's character was of great interest and importance. Who Ehud was important to the narrative of this story. It's been said to me that Ehud was likely had some form of deformity or was not able to use his arm, but as I was studying this throughout this week, it became clearer and clearer and clearer to me that Ehud did not have a deformity, but that Ehud was likely an exceptionally skilled warrior. And I'll share with you what I mean. We read here that Ehud's left-handedness was a focal point, that he was left-handed. This is very evident, it's very specified, it's pointed to. And what I began to see as I studied this was Ehud's left-handedness was probably the result of training, intense training, of years and years and years of practicing to use his left hand. The word left-handed here occurs elsewhere in Judges, but the only time in Judges, in Judges chapter 20, verse 16, where Ehud's condition is generalized to an entire contingent of Benjamite warriors. The same word is found only in Psalms 69, verse 15, where it means to shut. And this is where we get this idea that he might have had a deformity of some sort. If the present word in this passage to be left-hand is associated with Psalm 69, 15 as left-handed, left-handed means something like restricted or shut with reference to the right hand, which just, again suggests some form of deformity, handicap, which has caused him to be left-handed. However, this meaning is excluded in chapter 20 of Judges, verse 16, which describes an entire contingent of those Benjamite soldiers. And this is what it says. It says, "Among all of these were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Every one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss." Like, you go to Man Day, and, like, you know, John Holtry's got his, like, little, like, bobbing ping pong ball that these guys are nailing with bow and arrows? Yeah, try to hit a hare, Justin Knopp. I'm calling you out. I want to see that this next year. No, they were skilled at what they were doing. They were taking a stone and they were able to be precise and effective with it. What we need to understand about slings is slings require great skill and the efficient use of two hands. These left-handed warriors wouldn't have been able to use the slings with just one hand. They had to have had two hands. In 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 2, it attests to a different form of expression, to left-handed, that which literally means to use the left hand. It seems best to follow the lead of the Septuagint in the word amphoterdexius and interpret Ehud's condition and that of the Benjaminites in 2016 as ambidextrous, that is, skilled in the use of both hands. The meaning of this is further fleshed out in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 12, where it describes this group of Benjamites as relatives to Saul, who defected to David, who were able to use both hands skillfully. It is said that they came to David armed with bows, and they were able to shoot arrows or sling stones right-handed or left-handed. So the adjective here for this left-handed man, this the meaning behind to shut or to restrict, actually suggests that Ehud and his fellow Benjamites in 2016 were not naturally left-handed. On the contrary, they were a specially trained group for whom dexterity with the left hand was created by the binding up of the right hand. Meaning, in order for them to be skilled at using their left hand, they would restrict and bind their right hand to become better left-handed. In combat, this would be a huge advantage over those who are just simply right-handed. So Ehud was not just a simple man that just happened to have a deformity. No, Ehud was a skilled and trained assassin warrior who was both right-handed and left-handed. Being able to use your left hand doesn't come naturally to me. If you're left-handed, you have to think the other way, that using your right hand doesn't come naturally to you. Have you ever seen me throw a baseball left-handed? That's funny. It's horrible. Like, Ezra throws better than me right-handed than I do left-handed. It's bad. Like, it's to be able to do that, to be able to use this, like, this is just dead. It holds my watch, is what this arm does. And that's it. Like, I don't do a whole lot with this. So for this man to be able to use his left hand, it took time, effort, practice and dedication to be able to have that kind of a skill set. So we see that he's skilled because of his training, because of the practice in using his left hand. But not only is he skilled in his training, but he's also mentally prepared. He's a man that his mind was ready to go. He was prepared and had planned out everything that he did. I mean, this is why we're given so much detail to this story, as it tells us exactly what happens, is because Ehud had to have been planned out. His strategy was planned. It was meticulous and planned and executed. He had a special dagger made, which we're told is a cubit, which is about 18 inches long. So that's about from your knuckles to your elbow. It's about 18 inches long, and the reason why it was crafted that way was to be able to hide under his garment. It would have been easy to smuggle in and to be unseen. Double-edged sword was specific because instead of a striking blow that would have caused a whole lot of mess, Ehud wanted to be quick and swift without a whole lot of mess, so he created the double-edged sword for a quick jab and stab. Being ambidextrous, Ehud fastened the dagger under his right garment to his right hip where no one would suspect it. Like, if you're walking in, you're a right-handed guy, your sword's not going to be on your right hip. You don't want to be like trying to like dig it up. It's not going to work. So you're going to have it on your left side to be able to pull it out quicker. Most of the people were likely right-handed. In fact, what's interesting about the name Benjamin, it means son of the right hand. So there's irony taking place in this story, but there's this emphasis that most people, common people, would have been right-handed. So for Ehud to be left-handed was kind of an anomaly. in that time. Even today, we don't have a, how many left-handers do we have in here this morning? Can you raise your hand? Yeah, just a few. That's more than I even thought. Hope you guys got scholarships and stuff, but rest of us right-handed people don't get that kind of a treatment. But yeah, so it's an anomaly even in our culture today. And so he plans this specifically, puts it under his right hip. We see that he dismisses the group and goes back alone. It's a lot easier to do this by himself than to have a bunch of people with him. Even how he arranges the private meeting with the king shows that he was planned. He uses the trust that he likely won in bringing the gift because the king was all about himself in vain. And so Ehud returns, and the king is likely thinking to himself, oh, I'm going to get more, especially when Ehud says that he's got a special gift, that he's got a secret message for the monarch. In verse 19, it says, I have a secret message for you, O king. What's interesting about how he says is the Hebrew word for message could mean word or message, but it could also mean thing, object, or even experience. So as the reader, when you're reading this, we all know he's not talking about a message. We all know that when he says, I have a secret item for you, he's talking about the dagger that's strapped to his hip. But the king interprets it at its most common sense and invites the guards and the servants to leave. Apparent that his plan of attack and escape were also planned out. He knew the layout of the throne room. He had to understand the workings of the inside in order to get out safely. This just doesn't happen. He doesn't stumble over this stuff. He was planned and prepared. He understood how the throne room was designed. And it's hard for us to kind of get a picture because we're reading this, and it says that the king was in the cool room in his chambers. And was like it gives this idea that there's this upper room somewhere, this special like AC-controlled place where he's sitting and just hanging out because it's hot. Well, we know there's no ACs back in the day, at least not the ones that we think of. Most of us who understand how the world works, when you want to get cooler, you don't go up. Heat rises, so you want to get lower. It's cooler below. So it's not likely this room that is kind of this little like AC area for him to chill out. Most likely what it's referring to is it's referring to an elevated throne room. That where Ehud presented the gift, he would have presented at the bottom of the steps looking up to the king who was elevated above everyone else. So when Ehud goes back, he again approaches the king and he says, I have a secret message for you. So the king sends out his servants, and because he knew that the king was conceited and all about himself, did you notice how he shifts his statement? He says, I have a secret message for you. And then he dropped below in verse 20. Then he says, I have a message from God for you. Like, not only is this a secret message, a special message for the king, it's a divine message. So he entices the king with this divine message to get closer. So then the king stands up, and in a moment's notice, Ehud runs up the steps, pulls out the sword from his thigh, and stabs the king. He gets sucked into his stomach and poop comes out. Like, let's just read it out as I had to say it today somewhere along the way. This is what happens. It gets sucked in and his bowels are evacuated all over the floor. Dung escapes. And you're like, whoa, why? Why is that important? It is actually extremely important in understanding how Ehud escaped and got out of there. So what happens is we see that Ehud, he doesn't touch the knife. He doesn't go in and try to kind of find it in there. Why? Because he doesn't want to stroll out of the king's room covered in blood and whatever else stuff is all over the floor. So he leaves it alone. And then we see that he turns and he exits out a porch. Now, when you look up the word for the porch, what you will find is there is disagreement on what this word means, and no one really has an understanding of what porch means. When we think of a porch, we think of an outside little, balcony area. And so most people just assume that Ehud just kind of jumped over this porch area, lowered himself down, and escaped. But what we read, we're hearing about the king, who was large, he likes comfort. We read about Ehud locking the door and escaping out of this porch. And then we come to a group of men, the servants, who go and they knock and kind of try to open up the door, and it's locked. And their first thought is what? Oh, he must be relieving himself. He must be going to the bathroom, is what that means. And so they stand and they kind of wait and they wait and wait until they get embarrassed, like, good grief, how long is this guy going to take? This is before cell phones and you can play games while you're going. Like, how long is this happening? So they get embarrassed by this. There's reasons why we have this detail. Likely then what this word porch means, it is a hole or an opening in the floor. That the king actually had a bathroom in his upper throne room for his comfort and ease for him to be able to go to the bathroom. And this is likely, there's more evidence based on this, based on the emphasis on the dung coming out, because when the servants come up, they think, oh, the door's locked, and likely it smells because the king's excrement is chilling out on the floor. So their logical conclusion is he's going to the bathroom. This is where it gets fun. The hole in the floor, in our day and age, it's likely the sewage drain. So Ehud locks the door behind himself to buy some time, opens up essentially the toilet, jumps in, and escapes through a door underneath of the throne room. Like, you just don't stumble into that. Like, it's just not like, oh, hey, I'm going to walk in, kill a guy, and let's see what happens after that. No, it was specific. It was planned out. He was prepared. Ehud's preparation enabled him to respond to God's call and fulfill his role in God's divine plan. Ehud was prepared. He was planned. He had practiced. At that point in his life, when God had called him to do, because he didn't sit idly by, he was active in developing his skill set, his talents, and even his mental fortitude, so that when God called him in that exact moment, he could respond to God's divine plan. Unfortunately, many Christians sit idly by, not honing their skills or practicing their gifts. And then when an opportunity arises to do ministry or to lead someone to Christ, the lack of preparation leads to fear, and instead of responding, they retreat. One of the main pushbacks I get when I ask people about sharing their faith is, I don't know what to say. You know what that communicates to me? Communicates that you haven't taken the time to learn what to say, and you haven't taken the time to practice it. So when you come and say, I don't know what to say, here's my response. Learn. Learn. If you don't know how to do it, learn it. Spend time discovering in God's Word how the gospel was presented. There are plenty of resources out there that help people share their faith. And then the next thing you need to do is practice. Practice, practice, practice. You're not going to get good at sharing your faith if you never actually share your faith. So yes, you're going to fall flat on your face from time to time. You're going to say things you wish you didn't say, but that is all part of the process to refine yourself so that when God calls you for a specific opportunity to make a difference in someone's life, you can respond, knowing that you are ready and prepared to respond. Odell Beckham Jr., a New York wide receiver, New York Giants wide receiver, let's not confuse them with the Jets. New York Giants wide receiver, he kind of hit the scene a few years ago as a rookie, and he's just a phenomenal athlete. And one of the things that kind of made him stand out above the rest of the wide receivers is that one-handed catch. You know, you see it replayed over and over again. He like jumps backward. I don't even know where he's looking. He's probably looking down the field, and he just kind of reaches back and catches the ball. It's absolutely amazing. But if you would talk to any one of those athletes about those shining moments in their careers, what they would tell you is that it came only after long hours of practice. The only reason he was able to make that catch was because he has caught thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of balls for every touchdown he's made. Those guys actually practice those catches. They practice going down awkwardly and reaching out and catching things because you never know what's going to happen on the football field. For us as Christians, we need to practice and practice and practice to be ready and prepared for when God calls us to whatever he calls us to. And this starts by understanding your shape. It starts by understanding how God has designed you and created you to do his will. If you don't know how you're gifted or skilled, when God calls you to do something, you're just going to kind of, I don't know what to do in that moment. We as a church understand that if we can help people understand how they are shaped for ministry, they're going to be effective when God has called them to do ministry. This is why Angie Houck, can you wave? Angie Houck helps lead our SHAPE ministry, which is designed to help our people understand what their spiritual gifts are, what their heart is, what their abilities are, what they're passionate about, and what experiences they have that they can use to do God's work. But then once we understand our shape, understand how we're created, understand how we're designed, we then need to actually practice it and live that out. Develop your spiritual gifts. See, we encourage you to serve in our church. to use your shape here at community to develop that and to hone that, not to keep you here. The idea behind developing your spiritual gifts here is so that you can use them out there. For Christians, we need to continue to learn, expounding on our resources and knowledge to give us more chances for ministry. If you're gifted at something and you're really good at something, maybe it's a time for you to learn a new hobby or a new skill set. The more things that you're good at, the more skill sets that you have, the more opportunities you're going to have to reach people for Jesus Christ. Keep using what God has even blessed you with. Some of us, we're blessed with skill sets that we don't ever use. But God has given you talents, He's given you skills, He's given you spiritual gifts to be used. So if you're good at writing, write. If you're good at painting, paint. If you're good at fixing a car, fix it. Keep doing it. Keep honing that skill because God may call you one day to change the tire of an old couple who's broken down in our parking lot. I had a meeting with Jim and Heidi the other day, just talk about life and ministry, and I look out the window and there's Jim, one of our mechanics, changing a tire. There was an opportunity God had for him to minister to some people, and he was ready because he has used the skill set that God has blessed him with. Keep using what God has blessed you with. Learn a new skill and develop your spiritual gifts. You may not catch a fish on your first or even your second time out, unless you go to the Boiling Springs Lake. That's cheating. But over time, you'll understand what works, what lures work, what bait works, what time of day you should go. And eventually, you will develop the touch needed to catch the fish. The more you fish, the better you get. So go fish. Not for people, not for fish, but for people. The third thing and the final thing that we see in Ehud's life is he had persistence. Persistence involves giving everything you have to accomplish God's plan, even if it might be difficult or painful. Vince Lombardi says, football is like life. It requires perseverance, self-denial, hard work, sacrifice, dedication, and respect for authority. I agree with Vince Lombardi, and I also think that applies to our faith. That football is a lot like our walk with God. It requires perseverance, self-denial, hard work, sacrifice, dedication, and respect for God. Ehud had those things. Ehud was persistent in his mission despite the cost and potential pain. His plan, think about his plan. His plan could have gone south at any moment. Like he walks in and instead of like, you know, actually getting the left-sided pat down, you know, one of the other guys pats the other leg and discovers the blade. There's many things that could have gone wrong. They could have heard a scream. They could have heard a cry. But he was willing to be persistent to God's mission despite the cost or the possibility of pain. At any point, he could have given up. I always wonder when I read this, when he went out with a group of people and he hit the idols, was that intentional or was he struggling in that moment? We're not told. It's kind of silent on that. But like most people, I think Ehud might have said, this could be bad, but I'm going to be faithful anyways. He also could have been rejected as Israel's leader. He really, as far as anything goes, was a nobody. Aside from the fact that he killed this king, there's not a whole lot about him. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, which was a kind of defunct tribe. They had these inner Israelite wars, these intertribal wars that consumed them and just wreaked havoc on them as a tribe. And so not a whole lot was expected from the tribe of Benjamin. But he was persistent. We see that Ehud have a lifestyle of persistence. You don't become a skilled warrior by not continuing to challenge and push yourself. You don't take on a king and an entire nation without the tenacity to look failure and keep going. Ehud's success was a result of his will to persevere. When I was in high school, my freshman year, I ran track. Surprise to you, I'm sure. Pastor Allen runs. He did, past tense. I ran track in high school, and I did the 300 hurdles, which are brutal. And the coach decided that one day it would be a really good idea for me to push myself. He said, if you want to be a better hurdler, if you want to do well, then you need to train with the top two hurdlers on the team. And what that entailed was sticking me between the two of them as we trained. And so we would warm up together, we would run together, and I would be smack dab in between the two of them. And the reason why is that if I felt like giving up or I got tired, I got ran over. So I had in front of me the number two guy, who I was apparently supposed to push, and behind the two of us was the number one guy, Michael Bond. And Michael was fast. If you know anything about track shoes, they hurt. They got little spikes on them. So you don't want to get run over by someone behind you running. And there were many days where I got ran over. Michael didn't care. He was a senior, and he bro, destroyed me a few times. I pushed myself to the point where I was throwing up on the track, trying not to get ran over by Michael. It just wasn't fun. But I kept going, I kept pushing, I kept pushing. You have to understand that Michael, he ran the 300 hurdles. His best record, as far as I could find, was 42.95 seconds. 300 hurdles, it's pretty fast. Like, I was happy that I broke 50. I was like, yay. My best time was 46 flat. I got ran over a lot. Is what that means. But it actually paid off. Although I was not as fast as them or as good as them, I was able to place seventh in counties and seventh in regionals. And I got a bid to go to the States, but then I went on a missions trip. You know, God comes first. But that's what happened. I actually got better as a result of persistence, perseverance, and willing to absorb some pain in my life. As Christians, when things get hard and uncertainties arise, we can't give up. We're not promised an easy life. We're not promised a cookie-cutter life. Things are going to get hard. Imagine what Ehud would have missed if he would have given up. Imagine what you're missing by not sticking things out. When met with failure, because you are going to fail, that's a part of learning, that's a part of growing, is you're going to fail. You don't walk the very first time. Babies trip and fall constantly before they're able to walk and even run. As Christians, it's the same. We are going to be met with failure. We are going to mess up. We are going to make mistakes. When met with failure, get back up and try again. The worst thing you can do is stay down. Stunted growth is a result of a lack of persistence. Success is often a result of time and resolve. And what we need to do is we need to ask Jesus for strength needed and to be devoted to Him. If you don't fish often, you have little chance of catching any fish. So keep fishing. It's not a license for the men in this room to seriously just actually go fishing. It's a reference to reaching people for Jesus. If you don't share your faith, if you don't reach out, you will have little chance of catching any fish. You have little chance of making a difference in someone's life. So keep reaching people for Jesus. What we need to understand, though, as we close and we wrap up, only when we are changed can we be agents of change. Only when we are changed can we be agents of change. We're told in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, "For we are His workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, when God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." The only reason that we are able to do the things that we do, the only reason we're able to make an impact is because, one, God has chosen to allow us to do that, but because of Christ working in us. What we need to understand is that the agent of change is Jesus, but that He has called us to help Him in that mission of changing the world. He's the one that delivers. He's the one that saves. He's like Ehud. God raised him up at the right time, in the right place, in the right role, in order to deliver us from our bondage of sin. So here's my challenge for you. This is what I want to encourage you to do. Three things this week. Is one, I want you to determine a skill that will position you to make the most impact. Think about your life. Think about the resources you have. Think about even the skill sets you have. Determine a skill that will position you to make the most impact. Then hone that skill. Practice that skill. and then devote yourself to using that skill to reach people for Jesus Christ. God has called Christians to change the world by fulfilling his purpose wherever they find themselves. My prayer for our church is that we would position ourselves in such a way, through proximity, practice, and persistence, that we would position ourselves in that way to be able to reach people for Jesus Christ. Would you pray with me? Father, we thank you so much for our time together in your word. We thank you for Ehud and this really bizarre story that we can draw such rich truths from, Father, that you have this desire to use us as your people. You have a desire to use us to reach this world. Lord, I pray that we would be intentional about our lives. Father, that we would place ourselves in close proximity to those who need ministered to, those who need to hear about Jesus. Lord, I pray that you would help us to assess where that is in our lives, what we can do in order to surround ourselves with those who need ministered to. Lord, I pray that you would help us to be dedicated in our practice, that we would become effective and efficient in our presenting of the gospel. Lord, I pray that when those opportunities arrive, you call us to share our faith, that we would persist and that we would pursue and stay consistent in that, that we would endure opposition and hardships and pain in order to proclaim the gospel. Lord, help us to never give up. Help us to be resilient, drawing our strength and power from the Holy Spirit in us. Lord, I pray that you would use this church to change this world. They would use us as agents of change, that our lives might reflect you in such a way that people see their need for you and put their faith and trust in your Son, Jesus. Father, I pray that you would just be with us as a church as we give back to you now a portion of what you bless us with. Father, may we use these tithes and offerings to build into our people this what they need in order to make a difference in the world. Lord, I pray that you would just bless our finances, that we would use them wisely in order to impact Carlisle. And Lord, I pray that you would just be with both the gift and the giver, Lord, that you would encourage hearts to give and that you would use those gifts to make much of you. Lord, I pray that you be with us now as we continue to worship through song, through prayer, and Lord, we give this time to you. It's in Jesus' name. Amen.